The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 374, The Autobiography of Joseph Smith in 3rd Nephi, by Robert D. Anderson.
Let's not turn on the slide projector. The slides aren't as great as I would like, but they will help, and you don't have to pay great attention to them. They couldn't find anyone who would discuss this. So what I thought we might do is I'm going to go over about two-thirds of the chapter in the forthcoming book, and we'll stop there. And then depending upon questions and what we want to do and our time, well, we can go on and complete or our choice. But there's a fairly easy break. I want to mention Michael Marquardt is here. He's one of the co-authors with Wesley Walters on a new book out of Signature called Inventing Mormonism, which has a great deal of detective sleuthing in it, of excellence, having to do with Palmyra in the very early days. And some of that has been incorporated and makes important sections of the coming book. And I recognize faces from last year, so some of you were here last year as well. That's on tape. It's called The Sword of Laban, and it deals with the first story in the Book of Mormon. This section now comes from 3rd Nephi, and the reason for selecting this, not only today but also in the book as the next chapter, is because it is so crystalline clear and so chronologically exact. Now, in the next issue of Dialogue also, that is in the coming issue, I summarized my underlying theological assumptions, and I discussed the approach of understanding in the Book of Mormon by the uses of technique of applied psychoanalysis. So if you don't subscribe to Dialogue, send it in now and tell them you want the next issue. So here I'm making just a few brief remarks. Some of these you will have heard last year, but I'm cutting this down. Patients tell their life story and emphasize problem areas repeatedly in treatment, but some areas of conflict are so painful to discuss and feel directly, they use a number of methods, conscious and unconscious, to modify their pain. They may talk about a friend with similar problems or discuss a movie or book that contains problems similar to their own. They may divide their history into two or more parts, telling fragments on one day and the other fragments on another day. The more painful the incident, the more repetitious the patient becomes in trying to work through difficult times. If the pain of sadness is too much on one day, they may reverse it into a euphoria, which will break down in the same day in later days and weeks. Their dreams will repeat their life stories. The therapist, what becomes increasingly important is not the life story, but the modifications to the life story which the patient brings to treatment. These modifications, exaggerations, similarities, aversions, combining, reversals, eliminations, projections, forgettings, denials, imagined compensations, division of the story into two or more parts are what help us in understanding the patient and in helping them face pain and make a more successful adaptation in life. This, then, is the challenge. Can the Book of Mormon be understood as a disguised autobiography of Joseph Smith? Does it reflect not only his psychological makeup, but represent specific incidents in 19th century frontier America? At this, such a psychobiography would be both an interpretive essay and a psychological detective story. But if this inquiry is successful, can repeated patterns in Smith's alteration of his life into the Book of Mormon stories be discerned, and then we can advance to another level, which would allow an expanded question. Can such observations contribute to a psychological understanding of Joseph Smith, and with this information, alongside his mother's biography and some other outside information, can we develop a reasonably complete psychoanalytic profile of Joseph Smith? What I wish to emphasize in my presentation is that today we require little psychoanalytic understanding or knowledge of psychoanalytic theory. The basic technique of allegory, simile, metaphor, and fantasy will be used. I do approach a comprehensive understanding of Joseph Smith in the forthcoming book, but not until the last chapter. This presentation, like last year's, uses the basic argument of simile and allegory, and as I did in the presentation from 1 Nephi. And the emphasis there was on Joseph's first decade in life, although later times were presented. In this version, the emphasis will be on his second decade and early adult period of life, although he begins the story in 3 Nephi around his age of 5 years old. The Joseph Smith family. I remind you briefly of his history, and this is very condensed. He was the fourth living child born into a dysfunctional family. The two oldest children were boys, Alvin and Hiram, and his immediate older sister was Sophronia. He had a mother predisposed to depression with thoughts of suicide and an alcoholic father. By the time Joseph was 3 years old, his father had entered into the cultural delusion of belief in magic and treasure digging. In this cultural delusional system, one hunted for lost animals, a lost ring, or buried gold and other treasures by the use of divining rods and repeating magic rituals in attempts to hold off the spirit who guarded the treasure. Those with special talent use a stone placed in a hat and the hat pulled up over the face to exclude light. When they looked at the stone in darkness, they saw magical answers to problems. The work was called scrying, S-C-R-Y-I-N-G, and the work was a scryer, a seer, or more commonly a peeper using a peepstone. The marriage of Joseph's parents had started off financially well off, but because of the father's misjudgments and bad luck, quickly deteriorated into poverty. They moved at least 10 times over a 16-year period, sometimes trying to avoid creditors and debts. When Joseph was 2 and a half, a younger brother, Samuel Harrison, was born. 2 years later, another brother was born and died in 11 days. With this death, the family entered an 8-year period of despair and near starvation. A sixth living child, William, was born and added to the burden. A typhoid epidemic struck all of the children in the family. Most horribly, little Joseph, who tells us he was, quote, 5 years old or thereabouts, unquote. After failings by other physicians, he was saved by Dr. Nathan Smith, the founder of Dartmouth Medical School, who performed dramatic but physically and emotionally traumatic surgery on Joseph. Joseph screamed so loud during the surgery that his mother heard him through walls and doors 100 yards away and ran back to a boy who was pale in an agony that, quote, cannot be described, unquote, in a room covered in gushing, bloody horror. Around the time of the surgery, Catherine was born, the seventh living child, and the mother tells us that the medical expenses demolished any financial gains the family had made. For the next 2 or 3 years, Joseph began a slow recovery, and the family survived without incident as farmers, renting or hiring out to other landlords. Perhaps 2 years after the surgery, beginning when Joseph was 7 to 8 years old, the family came close to starvation for 3 years while Joseph continued his recovery. The father tried to grow crops, but the family had to live from day to day, not knowing where their food would come from. There would have been some days of hunger and perhaps even scrapping at the table. A volcanic eruption in Indonesia made things worse by creating a year-long volcanic winter. There was a European famine and snow and ice in Vermont in the very middle of summer in 1816. The father then determined to go to the promised land of upstate New York where, quote, farmers raise wheat in abundance, unquote, and he would later claim that he received direction from magic. The mother had just given birth to their eighth living child, a son named Don Carlos, born in March of 1816. The father had left them and began to settle in the town of Palmyra, then sent for the family. The mother had to fight off and pay creditors before she left with the eight children, and they were led by one Caleb Howard, a nasty man who treated them with disdain, spent the money on drinking, gambling, and making merry with the daughters of another family named Gates, while he forced Joseph, still lame and weak, to walk through the volcanically caused snow of that autumn or fall. The children were beaten with the butt of the whip, and once Joseph was knocked down into mud in his own blood. A stranger carried him into the town of Palmyra, probably in the fall of 1816. The family rented a cabin on the edge of Palmyra village and survived for 3 or 4 years by making root beer, cakes, birch brooms, and hiring out as common farm laborers to the neighbors. They were now above hunger,
and no longer in desperation, and their years of desolation were over. From the time of the death of the baby Ephraim in March of 1810, who died in 11 days, through the typhoid epidemic and surgery, the fleeing of creditors in multiple moves, the 3 years of near starvation, through the emigration and pain and humiliation to New York, and 1 or 2 years of survival in the village by odd jobs, they had suffered for 7 to 8 years. This, you remember, is the 7 or 8 years in the wilderness that was depicted in 1 Nephi. The father's drinking and involvement in magic rituals continued. Almost 4 years after arrival in Palmyra in the spring of 1820, they moved on to a piece of land 2 miles south of the village and built a small smoky cabin, and here their last child, Lucy, would be born 1 year later. In July of 1821, when she was born, it was during the spring of 1820 that Joseph reported his first vision when he would have been 14 years old, but no one else knew this story. Not mother, father, family, friends, or enemies. He connected it to a revival in Palmyra in 1820, but there was no revival in or around Palmyra between 1818 and 1823. Further, when he later began to develop this, quote, first vision story, the known remaining preliminary versions differ in his age, the reason for prayer, the initial supernatural responses, messages from the heavenly messengers, and the number and identity of messengers, God, God and Jesus, Jesus, or Jesus and angels. At the time he dictated the Book of Mormon, this story did not exist, and so does not appear in either direct or disguised versions in the Book of Mormon. Probably in the spring of 1822, they then moved again a short distance still south, but this time felt financially secure enough to start a purchase of land and built another cabin. The neighbors described their place as unkept and their work as slovenly, halfway, and profitless. The family, and notably Joseph, were described as idle and seemed directionless. They were viewed with amiable contempt by the townspeople, and some wondered if they were living by thievery. During this period, that is, when Joseph was 15 and 16, he took part in the local debating club and became an exhorter in the Methodist Church. This term was a formal designation, a formal position, of a young person who had some talent at speaking. Simultaneously, he was following his father into the use of magic to search for buried treasure, first with the use of a divining rod, and then around the age of 17 with the use of a seer stone. The year 1823 began with ordinary farm work, but ended in miracle and grief. They began to erect a frame farmhouse, the one we all know, under the leadership of the oldest brother, Alvin, in the fall of 1823. During that same period, at the autumn equinox on September 22nd, Joseph reported his prayer and visit from the guardian angel of a buried gold book in the Hill Cumorah 2 miles south of their farm. In the original stories, Joseph would get the book at the first visit, but he disobeyed the guardian angel. The ritual was broken when he put the book down to, quote, look for something else, unquote. He was knocked down and not allowed to take the book. He was told to bring his oldest brother with him at the next visit in 1 year. 2 months after the visit of the guardian angel, the oldest, quote, serious and industrious, unquote, Alvin, was struck by illness. A substitute, inexperienced physician from the next town gave the toxic mercurius chloride, calomel, to Alvin, who died after 4 agonizing days on November 19, 1823. At the autopsy, the local physicians referred to the death as murder by quackery. Shortly thereafter, at his funeral, the Presbyterian minister Benjamin Stockton implied Alvin might go to hell because he had not joined a church. This sermon alienated Joseph Smith Sr. from the Presbyterians. Within a few months, the famous revival that Joseph describes in his first vision story began, not in 1820, but in 1824 in the spring, and expanded dramatically with the arrival in September of 1824 of the Methodist revivalist George Lane. George Lane, it will be remembered, was the one who preached the sermon on James 1 and 5, if any of you lack of wisdom, let him ask of God, etc., that so influenced young Joseph. Manifestations of the Holy Spirit were multiple, and people joined the Methodists, Presbyterians, and Baptists. it was truly a local phenomenon. For in a town, Palmyra, of 3,500 people, almost 450 joined these congregations, and over one half of the baptisms occurred in the first 3 months of 1825. The revival was over 1.5 years after the death of Joseph's brother Alvin. We emphasize in passing that the revival occurred a few months after the death of Alvin, not 3.5 years before. Was Joseph more than a passive participant in the revival? He states he was partial to George Lane's Methodism, but 2 years earlier he had already been an active exhorter in that church. 6 months after the revival was over, around October of 1825, Joseph was visited by Josiah Stowell, a wealthy farmer who lived 120 miles away, near Pennsylvania. Deacon Stowell had been trying unsuccessfully to find a legendary Spanish mine about 20 miles from his home. He had heard about Joseph's seer stone magic talents from his son, who lived in the Palmyra area. Joseph convinced the old farmer of his talents by describing parts of his farm, including some specific details. That is, he described Josiah Stowell's farm 120 miles away. Joseph moved to the area of South Bainbridge, New York, about 20 miles from Pennsylvania, to help to find the cache of gold the Spaniards had supposedly left. He boarded at the home of Isaac Hale and there met his daughter Emma, who would later become his wife. Steadily, the children of Josiah Stowell became incensed at this young seer who might take their inheritance from their father, and had him brought to trial as a disorderly person and impostor. A pre-trial examination was held, and the two written reports of that examination, one official and one unofficial, separately or combined, paint such a picture of charlatanism, quackery, delusional belief, self-deceit, and deceit of others by the young magical seer Joseph Smith that the rediscovery of this examination raises permanent questions about the integrity and honesty of any subsequent act by this young magician. Mormon historian Marvin Hill states he experienced, quote, shame and humiliation, unquote, at this trial. He must have been devastated by the public display and general appalled public opinion concerning his claims to supernatural abilities. He never once mentioned the trial in any of his writings. It is hard to find anything in the reports of this pre-trial examination that reminds one of biblical teaching or Christianity. He was, from the combined readings of five official, contemporary, and subsequent reports, found guilty, but allowed to avoid a full trial and punishment if he would only get out of town and quit his supernatural claims. Joseph left town but remained in the area working for his friend Joseph Knight in nearby Colesville. He continued to visit Josiah Stowell, and Emma visited also. With the encouragement of the old farmer, Emma accepted Joseph's proposal over the opposition of her father. They eloped and were married in January of 1827, 10 months after his trial. He immediately took her home to Palmyra. In the interim, the Smith family in Palmyra had lost their house and farm. When the second payment for their land and cabin had been due around August 1821, they had been saved by the sole energetic work of Alvin, who brought home that primary payment. The third payment, due in the next year, in August of 1822, was avoided because of the death of the land agent the month before. Instead of saving the money or preparing for the impending payment, this childlike family spent the money, probably on the farmhouse building we all know so well. And then when the new land agent demanded the money 3 years later, the energetic and responsible Alvin was dead. They did not have the money. They had had 3 years to save for it. They lost the land and the building. They were allowed to live in their own farmhouse as tenants for the next 2 years, and it was as tenants that Emma first met her new in-law family. One neighbor remembered her bitter tears at being deceived. Some 8 months later, Emma went with Joseph to the Hill Cumorah for following the death of Alvin. She had been chosen by the angel to be his replacement. This apparently was one of the reasons for their marriage. That night of September 22nd, 1827, at the Hill, depending upon who you read, she remained in the wagon and or knelt and prayed and or turned her back while he dug up the gold plates and hid them in an old tree trunk. Let's stop there. We'll interrupt it and we can complete it if we have time, but let's go to the Book of Mormon. Let's see. Anybody who knows how the switch on the back, far side, the other side, other side, other side. Just turn it on the on to on high. High, if you got it. Okay, don't do anything more yet. Okay. The autobiography in 3rd Nephi. In order to begin demonstrating how these key events in Joseph Smith's early adult life find their way into the Book of Mormon, I'll focus on this 2nd Nephi, also a major alter ego for Smith in the Book of Nephi, now labeled the Book of 3rd Nephi within the Book of Mormon. This 2nd Nephi is the namesake of the 1st Nephi and lives some 500 years later, just before the coming of Jesus Christ to the Americas. The narrative of the 1st Nephi, which I presented last year, told in disguised form the story of Joseph's early years, with emphasis on those events through the age of 13. This time the focus will be on his second and third decade of life, but will quickly review Joseph's surgery in the years of near starvation, then continue through the revival, death of his brother Alvin, his trial, loss of firstborn son, and loss of the manuscript, and 7 months of normal living began before he begins the dictation of the Book of Mormon in earnest. We may not be covering them, some of those.
It's connected to you.
Yeah, I know. Okay, I don't want the slide on quite yet. This retelling of Smith's life through this 2nd Nephi in the book of 3rd Nephi will also display many of the same patterns of relation demonstrated in the first story. One recurring pattern is the rather exact chronological correlation between the events in the Book of Mormon narrative and the events in Joseph's life. Strikingly, the correlation for Nephi's disguised reliving of Joseph's story is virtually year for year. There is narrative preparation for Joseph's personal story. A Lamanite prophet, Samuel, had come and gone 5 years previously, telling the date of Christ's birth in the land they had left 600 years earlier. The miracles would include the Star of Bethlehem, and on the night of his birth, the sun would set without darkness. Unbelievers in the land insisted that the 5 years had already passed, and they set a day apart for killing those who believed these prophecies. Nephi Jr., his father was Nephi Sr., sorrowfully and distraught, prayed for one full day when the Lord spoke to him, saying, "On the morrow come I into the world." The signs appeared, the wicked people temporarily repented, and there was a great remission of sins, quote-unquote. However, in the mountains, a secret band of murderers and robbers called the Gadianton Band expanded in size in the year 1 AD by using flattery and deceit. The Nephites in the Book of Mormon are characterized by the constancy of their inconstancy. They, similar to the Smith family, were not capable of commitment or dedication. So by 3 AD, 3 years after the great remission of sins, they were beginning to, quote, wax strong in wickedness and abominations, unquote. This continued for the next 10 years, despite preaching and prophesying by the fewer and fewer righteous. Meanwhile, the Gadianton Band of robbers enlarged and destroyed cities, as well as created carnage and death. Some of the Lamanites have been converted to the Lord and joined with Nephites in defense against these robbers. In these wars, the Gadianton Band threatened with destruction of the country in 13 AD, but the Nephites gave an upper hand 1 year later. The robbers attacked again in 15 AD, and then in the year 16 AD, the leader of the robbers sent a letter to the head of the country, who was named Lyconius, demanding capitulation, or stated he would completely destroy them. The Latin name startles us in a book of supposedly Hebrew and Egyptian roots, but even more so, the letter is simplistic and reminds us of a story written by an imaginative young boy. It alerts us to pay close attention. The robber praised Lyconius for his firmness in maintaining, quote, defense of your liberty and your property and your country, and it seemeth a pity unto me, most noble Lyconius, that you should be so foolish and vain to suppose that you can stand against so many brave men, which are at my command, and do await for the word, go down and destroy. He gave Lyconius two choices: capitulate and join the band of robbers, or else, quote, on the morrow month I will command my army shall come down and shall let fall the sword upon you, unquote. There is a vague familiarity to this letter, as if one had read it before. To summarize its message, You are very brave, but I am giving you two terrible choices. That makes it clearer. Here is the source of the story. Quote, said I, doctor, can you not try once more by cutting around the bone, and thus you may save the leg? You will not take off the leg until you try one more time. The doctor said, my poor boy, we have come again. Yes, said Joseph, I see you have, but you have not come to take off my leg, have you, sir? No, said the surgeon, it is your mother's request that we should make one more effort. First slide. Okay, well, you can follow it. Okay. Lycaonia's Lucy, Joseph's mother, negotiating with the robbers with swords, the surgeons, and being faced with the two choices of amputation or operation for the osteomyelitis. In this real-life story, Joseph's incompetent father crashed into sobs, and young Joseph demonstrated his bravery by refusing to be bound with cords or inebriated with wine, and he faced the surgeon without his mother. His bravery did not keep him from the pain. In the Book of Mormon, the Nephites began to gather for battle by the tens of thousands. Taking with them their horses, chariots, cattle, flocks, and grain, they moved to and fortified one single area as well as made weapons. The robbers came out of the hills, but the Nephites had left the land desolate of food, so the robbers must attack or starve. But the Nephites had been frightened into repentance and had saved enough food for 7 years in the fortress land. 7 years. Remember, in the first story, it was 8 years in the wilderness. In this second retelling.
Excuse me, can we move this? This is absolutely unreadable. Turn the line off.
We have to turn this line off.
Okay, let's see what we can do here. How about this?
There we go.
Okay. In this second retelling, the bloody private events is transformed by the Book of Mormon into a national war which occurred in the sixth month of A.D. 19 and corresponds to the year 1811, A.D. 19, A.D. 11. We will now have an exact correlation of the years in Joseph's memory. Quote, great and terrible was the slaughter thereof, insomuch that there was never known so great a slaughter among the people of Lehi since he left Jerusalem. This is the worst battle in 600 years of Nephite history. The Gadianton band attacked with lambskins around their loins, heads shorn, and bodies dyed in blood, and, quote, great and terrible was the appearance of the armies, unquote. Here is Joseph's surgery, and there is blood everywhere, all over the surgeon's, Joseph, the bed. His mother said, oh, my God, what a spectacle for a mother's eye. The wound torn open to view, and my boy in the bed, on which he covered with blood, which was still gushing from the wound. He was pale as a corpse, and his face and every feature on which depicted agony that cannot be described. The surgery has been expanded into national wars. The Nephites won the battle and chased the robbers to the borders of the wilderness. The leaders of the robber was, quote, weary because of much fighting, overtaken and slain, unquote. So once again, as in the first story of Nephi, in the start of the Book of Mormon, the surgeon was a robber and had been cut down by the sword. Little Joseph is conquered in fantasy again. The Nephites would remain in their fortress encampment for 7 years, but the first two and a half were quiet and historically corresponds to the first years of recovery after Joseph's surgery. The robbers withdrew to the hills and did not return for 2.5 years when they lay siege to the fortress encampment of the Nephites, 21 A.D. This represents the beginning of the near-starving time of the Smiths in 1813. But the fear and desperation of those 3 years of near-starvation of the Smith family from 1813 to 1816 was overcome by the storage the Nephites had made. The tables were turned once again, and it was the robbers who had only a dwindling supply of wilderness game, quote, insomuch that the robbers were about to perish with hunger, unquote. Joseph Smith has conquered the hunger of those years by the use of fantasy and giving starvation to the surgeons, who have now become a national faction of thieves and murderers. War maneuvers continued, and the Nephites decimated the robbers and hung their new leader. Some of the thieves were imprisoned, and some repented and were freed. Following young Joseph's surgery and the recovery of the family episode of typhoid illness, the mother said, quote, and I assure you, we realize the blessings, for I believe we felt more to acknowledge the hand of God in preserving our lives through such a desperate siege.
In the Book of Mormon, this was exaggerated into the people who, quote, did break forth all as one in singing and praising their God for the great thing which he had done for them in preserving them from falling into the hands of the enemies. Yea, they did cry Hosanna to the Most High God, unquote. Joseph's struggle toward claims of omnipotent power over people had been temporarily frightened out of him. He projected this onto the people in the Book of Mormon. Quote, they knew it was because of their repentance and their humility that they had been delivered from everlasting destruction. And now, behold, there was not a living soul among all the people of the Nephites which did doubt in the least thing in the words of all the holy prophets which had been spoken. They forsook all their sins, abominations, and whoredoms, and did serve God. This was in A.D. 21 or 22, which corresponds to 1813 or 1814 in real life. But Joseph Smith did not have adequate ability to resist the struggle toward power. His repentance, as seen in the people, faded as the years passed, and they recovered from the surgery. 3 years passed without incident. The year in the Book of Mormon was now 26 A.D., corresponding to 1818, 7 years after the battle. And the people did return to their own lands, quote-unquote, from their fortress encampment, taking with them their animals, treasures, remaining food, and other goods. And thus, too, did the siege starvation period of the Smith family end when they moved to New York and settled in their log cabin home in Palmyra 7 years after the surgery battle. The next 3 years comprise a period of relative tranquility in the Book of Mormon. Quote, there was great order in the land, and they had formed their laws according to equity and justice, and now there was nothing in all the lands to hinder the people from prospering continually. There were many cities built anew, and many highways cast up, and many roads made, which went from city to city, and from land to land, and from place to place. And thus passed the 28th year, corresponding to 1820, and the people had continued peace. This period, described in the Book of Mormon, a tranquility for the Smith family, paralleled what has been called the era of good feeling, quote unquote, in the larger context of American history during the first term of President James Monroe between 1816 and 1820. It was in 1818, for example, that the Cumberland Road, called the National Road, reached Ohio and opened up Kentucky, Tennessee, and lands westward. It is possible then to see the larger social context for the Smith struggles finding their way in disguised form in the pages of the Book of Mormon. In A.D. 29, corresponding to 1821, this prosperity in the Book of Mormon is disrupted by sin in the form of, quote, disputings, pride, and boastings because of riches, unquote. Problems arose with, quote, lawyers, officers, social class ranks according to their riches and their chances for learning. Yea, some were ignorant because of their poverty, and others did receive great learning because of their riches, unquote. Certainly the state of affairs calls up how life must have been viewed by a 15-year-old boy growing up in the midst of a struggling and poorly educated family in Palmyra. Joseph had written that because of, quote, indigent circumstances, we were deprived of the benefit of an education, unquote. In 30 A.D., am I up to date? Okay, sort of. In 30 A.D., the Book of Mormon begins to fall apart because of awful wickedness. The next 3 years of Nephite history seem to roughly correspond to the years 1823 to 1826, in the Smith family life. In 1826, the United States was rocked by a murder of a Mason who had revealed secret Masonic rites. This, taken with the widespread belief that Masons were secretly controlling the government, courts, and elections, brought a wave of national paranoia which lasted for over a decade. The Mason, by name William Morgan, had been given a secret mock trial 9 miles from the Smith farmhouse and then was taken secretly to Fort Niagara on the Canadian border, where he disappeared. 5 Masons were tried. They were acquitted, and the other 2 received sentences of less than a year. This story finds its way into the Book of Mormon as the corruption of the Nephite judges with the Gadianton band. These judges made secret covenants, quote, to deliver those which were guilty of murder from the grasp of justice, unquote. Further, by these satanic agreements, they did murder the chief judge of the land. During this time, the government in ancient America was collapsing. The church, quote, began to be broken up, and the people, quote, were divided one against another into tribes, every man according to his family and his kindreds and friends, and thus they did destroy the government of the land. The larger American context for the period of 1823 to 1826 also suggestively echoes the turmoil figured in the Book of Mormon. The second term of President James Monroe, between 1820 to 1824, was characterized by sectional hostility and individual political rivalries. This included bitter arguing over slavery. Maine said no, Missouri said yes, and culminated in the election of 1824. Neither the chief judge or the president was murdered, but one could argue that the democratic process was. This had been a one-party election with four candidates. Andrew Jackson received 99 electoral votes, John Quincy Adams 84, Crawford 41, and Henry Clay 37. No one had a constitutional majority, although the will of the people was reasonably clear. By law, the election was decided in the U.S. House of Representatives, where Henry Clay met secretly with John Quincy Adams and gave him his electoral votes in February of 1825. In return, Adams made Clay the Secretary of State. Cries of corruption spread through the land. One newspaper editor exclaimed, quote, expired at Washington on the 9th of February of poison administered by the assassin hands of John Quincy Adams, the usurper, and Henry Clay. They have killed the virtue, liberty, and independence of the United States. Locally in Palmyra, the years 18 to 1824, corresponding to 31 to 32 A.D., saw not only the election but the beginning of the period of competitive religious revivalism. Joseph later wrote about the, quote, great love, unquote, of the converts of the different sects, which he saw as, quote, more pretended than real, for a feeling of great confusion and bad feeling ensued, priest against priest and convert against convert, so that all the good feelings for one another, if they had any, were entirely lost in a strife of words. Likewise, in the Book of Mormon story, there is increasing sinfulness. Quote, and thus six years had not passed away since the more part of the people had turned from the righteousness, like the dog to his vomit, or the sow to her wallowing in the mire, unquote. The year was now 31 A.D., corresponding to 1823. This division into tribes had some strict laws so that, quote, in some degree they had peace in the land and war was avoided. Let's skip that. But, well, here, I can show you this. But the people were stoning the prophets, and one they killed near the end of that year was the brother of Nephi. The year corresponds to... The people were stoning the prophets, and one they killed near the end of that year was the brother of Nephi. At this point, Smith presents a story which compensates in the most striking way for the personal tragedies and problems that beset the Smiths at about the time of the contentions of the revival period. It was about this time, we can recall, that Smith was visited by the angel and that his brother Alvin died, the hands of murderer by quackery, the doctors. In the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith's alter ego, Nephi, hears the voice of the Lord and sees angels and begins to preach within a volatile context. We are told that he, quote, did minister with the power and great authority, and then, quote, and even his brother did he raise from the dead after he had been stoned, unquote. In the Old Testament, Elijah had raised the widow's son, and Elisha had performed a similar miracle. In the New Testament, Jesus had raised three, including Lazarus, from the dead, but who has also repaired a broken body with a crushed skull. Nephi's raising of his dead brother before Jesus had been resurrected is indeed a miracle. We are told that the people who had stoned his brother saw the raising of the dead man and were very angry with Nephi, quote unquote, because of his power, and he did also many more miracles in the sight of the people in the name of Jesus. Of course, in Joseph Smith's own life, as he was beginning to tell of his own miracles with a guardian of plates of gold, his beloved brother Alvin died near the end of 1823, not stoned by a mob, but rather killed through medical stupidity. Once again, as with the surgeons in the starving years, Joseph has reversed the scene and conquered the tragedy by fantasy. Also, he rewrites the story of power and authority over a brother, already seen in the story of the first Nephi as a miracle of God. With this story, Smith is also moving chronically beyond the period depicted in the narrative in the first part of the Book of Mormon and into the stories of his young adulthood. Nephi's preaching begins a period of religious activity among the people. The revival, just as in real life, began slowly. Quote, and it came to pass that the 30 and first year, corresponding 1823, did pass away, and there were but few which converted unto the Lord, unquote, which is a historically accurate statement. Those converted performed miracles and healings, and the 30 and second year, corresponding to 1824, passed similarly. But Nephi continued to preach to the people, and by the 30 and third year, corresponding to 1825, there were, quote, many in the commencement of that year that were baptized unto repentance, and thus the more part of the year did pass away. This description of religious preaching and conversion can be seen as a strikingly accurate description of the revival near Palmyra, which commenced in the spring of 1824, 4 or 5 months after the death of Alvin, and continued moderately until almost a year after Alvin's death. Historically, half of the baptisms of the converts occurred in the first 3 months of 1825, or as Nephi recorded, there were many in the commencement of that year, 33 AD, that were baptized, and the year did pass away. The revival was over in both the Book of Mormon and Palmyra 1.5 to 2 years after the death of the brother. Of course, Smith has again reversed the situation and made it a sign of his own emerging religious power and authority. Smith's own role as a near convert, almost to Methodism, had been transformed into the leadership of the religious revival, and he has replaced the Reverends Benjamin Stockton and George Lane as a religious leader. At the end of the period of religious controversy comes the crucifixion of Christ, which occurs in the Book of Mormon, quote, in the 30 and fourth year, in the first month, in the fourth day of the month, unquote. This would be roughly 27 months after the stoning and resurrection of Nephi's brother, and would correspond to 27 months after the death of Alvin, roughly in 1826, early 1826. In the Bible account of the crucifixion, Matthew recorded that the, quote, earth did quake and rocks rent. Mark and Luke recorded 3 hours of darkness, and all three recorded the rending of the veil in the temple. In the Book of Mormon, by now seen as a typical pattern, exaggerating these descriptions, they are exaggerated into a geophysical holocaust. This cataclysm begins with a terrible storm, expands into fire and convulsing earthquakes, which sank cities into the sea and under the earth, and changed the whole face of the northern lands, breaking up highways and roads. 16 cities, quote, and great cities, unquote, had been destroyed with all their inhabitants, children and infants included. It ended in about 3 hours, then was replaced by thick darkness, so thick that those still alive could feel its vapor and no fire or candle could be lit. This pitch blackness lasted for 3 days, and all one could do was feel his way around and listen to the howlings, mournings, and weepings of the sorrowful people. Oh, that we had repented and not stoned the prophets, then would our mothers and our fair daughters and our children have been spared. This was a selective miracle, for it was, quote, because of their iniquity and abominations that they had fallen. The, quote, more righteous, unquote, were spared. A voice was now heard by everyone everywhere who remained alive, which said, woe, woe, woe unto this people. Woe unto the inhabitants of the whole earth, except they shall repent. Behold, that great city Zarahemla have I burned with fire, and the great city Moroni have I caused to be sunk in the depths of the sea, and the great city Moroni-ha have I covered with earth, and the city of Gilga sunk, and the cities of Onahai and Mokiam, Gadiamna, Jacob, and Jejimno to be sunk, and made hills and valleys in the places thereof. And the cities of Laman and Josh, Gad, and Kishkumen have I caused to be burned with fire. Who has done this monstrous deed in destroying lands, cities, men, women, and children? Where was this destroyer during the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews? The voice speaks again, and it was the God of love. Behold, I am Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I am the light and life of the world. Then Jesus, Now the resurrected Christ appeared in the sky overhead and descended to give these people his teachings of love and kindness, including the Sermon on the Mount. Today, Mormon geologists look for evidence of this geophysical holocaust in the oceans off of Chile and Peru. And Mormon archaeologists look for evidence of a Middle East culture or language or anything resembling the Nephite Lamanite story throughout the Americas. With no scientific or historical evidence anywhere for this story, we are justified to looking to the personal story of Joseph Smith. The geophysical holocaust in the Book of Mormon comes as a judgment from God and represents the time when Joseph Smith stood before a judgment bar and was found wanting. Psychologically, this fantasy of external destruction reveals how shattered he was by his trial for magic and money, and his difficulty in handling shame and humiliation is proportional to the magnitude of the devastation. Every psychiatrist has heard patients present dreams and fantasies of volcanoes and earthquakes. There is a type of personality which cannot handle shame or humiliation, and even ordinary slights, rebuffs, or insults are felt with maximum and frightening intensity. The emotional response to such slights feels like an earthquake. The defenses of such vulnerable people include surrounding themselves with compliant people whom they use as buffers to the outside world. But if these buffers are inadequate or unavailable, then the personality of such a person is terribly shaken. This story makes a contribution to the diagnostic profile of Joseph Smith. I'll stop there. I'll take questions, whatever you want to do.
Is it your thesis that Joseph Smith did this consciously or unconsciously?
Half and half. I don't think he was typical. What we call the repression barrier is an indicator of health. Healthy people have a repression barrier. We use it to eliminate a lot of stuff we don't need in our conscious thinking mind, and can eliminate minor problems from it. We get into trouble when we try to push major problems into the unconscious. I don't think he had what we would call an ordinary repression barrier. And I think ideas slipped in and out in a more fluid state than we know of. But I think he knew what he was doing at this period of time.
This period of time being?
The Book of Mormon dictation.
16 years old?
No. When he was dictating the Book of Mormon.
Thank you.
Okay, when he was dictating the book. So the question has been, was Joseph Smith a kind of broader, expanded form of medium that can receive some kind of, we'd still call it supernatural experiences from the universe? I don't know. I don't have information to support or deny that. We know some of the immediate answers for that. Martin Harris, beginning very early, talked about that his spiritual eyes had seen the Book of Mormon, and he emphasized this any number of times, and he was very clearly after the Book of Mormon for money. Any number of people quoted him. Martin Harris was also a wife beater, as you know, and a rather religious flake. He had joined five different religious sects before Joseph Smith, and then went on to join a number of others, leaving Mormonism back and forth over the next years. Oliver Cowdery is now strongly suspected of being the coordinator, the facilitating school teacher for Joseph Smith. He is the connecting link with the historian, with the theologian Ethan Smith, who wrote A View of the Hebrews. Oliver Cowdery's family had belonged to the congregation of Ethan Smith in Pulteney, Vermont. And the book by Ethan Smith, A View of the Hebrews, forms the basis of the comparison in Brigham H. Roberts' book, the studies of the Book of Mormon, which Brigham Manson edited, and it is the comparison of those. The connected link between Ethan Smith and Joseph Smith, the congregational minister and theologian who presented the idea and the concept that the whole American Indians were from Israel, and Joseph Smith, the connecting link is Oliver Cowdery, and the fact his family belonged to Ethan Smith's congregation. David Whitmer seems to be the most upright, solid, contributing person, and yet he later, in his testimony after he leaves Mormonism,
declares that a voice of God had told him that Joseph Smith was now a fallen prophet. So we have to, and that's easily available and read. So now we have any number of puzzles. There is no good explanation of the experience of the eight witnesses except from Governor Thomas Ford, who writes the only one that, and we don't know who he got it from, but he writes as if somebody had told him, and he talks about it. And he talks about Joseph Smith just hammering at these people, demanding that they see these plates, and that they go. He goes through on and on, pounding at them that they have to pray until they see it, and just putting a tremendous amount of coercion on them. So, I don't know if this answers, but those are. I don't think he ever recalled a first vision. I think he started to develop the story. Yes, I think the first indicator is in the Book of Mormon. The very first indicator of it all is in the Book of Mormon. Embryonic, undifferentiated. It's when Mormon declares that he, in his 15th year of age, at the very end of the Book of Mormon, Mormon declares that in his 15th year of age, he was visited and knew Jesus. I think it's Moroni 1 and 15 or something like that. I think that's the very first indicator of it. The stories that we know came from 1832, 1835, and 1838 as he progressively develops. What I think happens, what I think happens is that it is the belief of the people that change a fantasy to a psychological reality in Joseph Smith. It cycles through the people, and it is their belief, their wish to elevate him, that makes it become steadily over time a psychological fact. And that fits with what I think is the main diagnostic profile of Joseph Smith.
The correlation that you find in Joseph's history with Third Nephi, you had to do that consciously. This wasn't just something that was subconscious.
Yeah.
You had to plan that out and work that out pretty carefully.
He's looking at a stone in a hat, hat pulled over his face, his wife sitting across the table saying for hours this went on, just looking in. He has to create a fantasy, and the only place he can get that fantasy is from his own personal life expanded. And that is what he is doing. And he's bringing in not only the government stuff that's happening at the time he's dictating, and he follows then stepwise the fantasy, and expands his own real life into a fantasy. Now, he had some preparation for this, because the family tells us, his mother tells us, that for years he sat around the fireside creating these stories of ancient America. We have at least two or three years of preparation doing this.
When the follow-up question, did this mean he was normal?
I don't think Joseph Smith is normal. Okay, here, over here. That's a good. The what? I have to go through the specific criteria of what 14 criteria they list for adult children's of ACOAs of adult children. But what I try to do is fit him into personality categories. Not just adult children, but take those particular characteristics and emphasize those. In the final chapters, I break his personality down into five components which combine, one of them being the belief in him by his people. They make an important contribution to his diagnostic profile.
On the alcoholic question, the opposite of everything is true, so... But I have a question about symbolism in the Book of Mormon. Like, you have the Sword of Laban, you have the lion, the iron rod. Is there some material in there that gives some insight into Joseph's personality?
Yes. Well, you need to hear my tape from last year on the Sword of Laban. The Liahona is a combination between a compass and a divining rod. The father's belief in magic, and the father declared that magic had led him to the land of New York. So we begin to wonder about the use of the divining rod and combining this. What was your third thing?
The iron rod where people hang on to the... It's a vision of
that's a direct quote from a dream of his father, the iron rod. It's dream number two recorded by Lucy Smith in her biography of Joseph Smith. She goes through and records five dreams, which she calls visions, that Joseph Smith Sr. had between 1811 and 1819. She calls them visions, just like in the Book of Mormon, Lehi says, I have dreamed a dream, or in other words, I have seen a vision. The second dream that Lucy records of Joseph is the Rod of Iron dream in the Book of Mormon. That's been known since 1902.
So Lehi would be actually Joseph Sr., if you transfer this. Is there any other similarity between Lehi and Joseph Sr.?
Get my tape. Last year.
It's on the book. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Even with the psychological problems of pulling all this together, it's hard for me to fathom that throughout the rest of his life, as he's pulling together a church and bringing people together and influencing people to come from England and coming from all over and going out into the wilderness, how none of this becomes apparent to anybody. How does he...
It became apparent to all the rest of the United States and all the rest of Britain. It didn't become apparent to my great-grandfather or my grandmother on my maternal side. It became apparent to everybody except those who believed it. And the reasons for that, I think, are important. They really constitute Volume 2 of the study of Joseph Smith, and that is his last 14 years. Volume 1, which really deals with the intrapsychic fantasies of Joseph Smith and his personal history. Volume 2, the last 14 years, will have a major section of the interpersonal, not intrapsychic, but interpersonal interactions with his people, with his followers, how they elevated him for their own gain, in which he was saying, basically, I will become the prophet who you want me to convince you that I am. And that puts the circle between him and his followers in the creation. I will become the prophet who you want me to convince you that I am. Okay? And that's what happens.
In your book, I'm trying to get a feel for what you're working on in your book.
So am I.
Hypothesize that, you said that some of the Book of Mormon has come from Joseph Smith's early life, just retelling his story. There's a borrowing from the Old Testament stories where Abraham and Jacob and so forth. There seems to be a lot of borrowing potentially from the Old Testament. Ethan Smith's view of the Hebrews, as you mentioned. And there seems to be a multitude of potential sources for Joseph Smith writing the Book of Mormon. Do you try to treat all of these aspects, or are you only trying to treat Joseph Smith's borrowing from events of his own personal life?
That's the central theme.
That's
the central theme. It has to be. It can't be anything else. He takes the outline, the concept of Ethan Smith's A View of the Hebrews, and the idea. And Ethan Smith had really formulated and brought together writings from the previous 400 years. And he brings all these together in the book that has to do with the concept that the American Indians were a product of the Hebrew race and nation. Fairly common belief, but it's that book that forms the concept and the outline of the Book of Mormon. Then everything within that concept and outline has got to come from Joseph Smith's life. He's sitting there at a table, his face buried in a hat, and he's coming out with material. He may be at other hours of the day reviewing the material from Ethan Smith or Josiah Priest's Wonders of Nature's Displayed. And the Holocaust Cataclysm comes from Josiah Priest. The story of the 2060 Ammonite use, the sons of Helaman that could not be injured, comes from a story in Josiah Priest. Expanded and fit in, and he's telling something about his personal life. He brings in the Old Testament story. Ammon is similar to David and Goliath. Abinadi is similar to who read the handwriting on the wall. You know, all of these are known. They bring in, but the central theme is he's telling his life story, and he does it again and again and again. Yeah, that was a new fact to me. I had accepted the 13-week long period of time, dictating hours at a time, going over it and over it and over it. And with the fantasies, I found that believable that he could do that 8 hours a day. We're talking a book of 588 pages, 275,000 words. But I think that's believable he could have. It would have been damn hard, and I consider it a prodigious feat, and Sam Taylor may be correct. I don't know. We know after he finished, we have some dates in which he went back. I think most of you now know that when he lost the 116 pages, when he went back, he stopped for 7 months. When he went back, he started with page 117. Completed through the end of the Book of Mormon, or maybe not quite, then he did the first fourth of the Book of Mormon again, and the joining point is in the 10th chapter of Mosiah. I think it's possible he could have done it in 13 weeks.
Isn't there a time span of 2 years between talking to the ancient Moroni and saying he's not getting the plates just now, and then the final time when he gets the plates, which would have given him time to think about his story?
Well, more than that, even. 1823 was the first episode of the angel. He doesn't get the plates till 1827. And various impediments, including his other cohorts, colleagues in treasure hunting, or said, you got gold and you're not sharing it like you said you would, and they start, and he has to move from Palmyra down to Harmony, and all sorts of things happen that delay it. But it, there was a total of 6-7 years from the first stage of. Right.
One of the things that's really, really been of interest to me since the time I was a Mormon missionary is the incredible ferocity with which people cling to the church and their belief system by praying about the Book of Mormon and receiving the personal witness.
Yeah.
I've begun to see those real psychological terms.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been through that, you know. I think like so many of us. We have to rely on both our intuition and our feelings and all sorts of things. We need this desperately, how we feel, how strong we feel about things, which include things like who we're going to marry, where we want to take vacations, what kind of work we want to do. Our internal feelings are very important to us. But we also expect those feelings to be correlated with reality. And that is, if you fall in love with somebody, you're certain that she's the right person, and then somebody comes along and tells you that she killed her previous husband, or that she'd been married, or she's still married, then you know, you got to correlate it with reality. And we have not one single bit of information, historical or scientific, to support the Book of Mormon from anywhere. Okay. And so what we're left with is this kind of raising questions. Is it group psychology? Is it a kind of self-inducement, one's own conviction and things like that? And there's much in here that would fulfill the deepest desires of anybody in terms of belief of answering the problems of death, natural disasters, where did we come from, the idea that we have a certain power over certain things, all these kind of things, and that the eternal world of omnipotent perfection had reached down and touched one spot on earth, one person, is a desperate longing that we all have from day one of our life.
Is it the upcoming book, is that the psychological profile, or is it going to be a...
At the end, I cover the first 25 years of Joseph Smith, up to the time of the Book of Mormon. And I go through the Book of Mormon, and then in the last chapter I elevate it into psychoanalytic stuff, putting it into a framework of psychoanalytic knowledge.
The large portions of the Book of Mormon are copied almost verbatim from the King James Version of the Bible. Do you find that those, what I'm after is, was all of the translating done by Joseph Smith better than him? I mean, was that done in some other way?
Good point. And for part of the time, there's reason to believe that, for example, at the first 116 pages, there was a curtain between him and Martin Harris in the first 116 pages, and the plates are supposedly in front of him using the spectacles on the breastplate. But the angel took those away as punishment when Martin Harris lost the 116 pages and didn't return them. After that, Joseph Smith was left with the stone in his hat. That was the means. The whole Book of Mormon as we now have it, was dictated, the stone and the hat. That's all we have. Then other people could watch, and he's described by at least eight people. Okay? David Whitmer gives the most comprehensive explanation, but so does Joseph Knight gives a very clear explanation. I think there were times in which he was doing it with collusion with Oliver Cowdery, and he might have been saying things like, well, this is stuff from Isaiah or something, and let's just go to the Bible and take it out of there. There were times he seems to be quoting from Ethan Smith as well. There's one quote by the lost Old Testament prophet Zenas that has an error, a quoting error from the Bible that seems to be a direct quote from Ethan Smith, who is misquoting the Bible. So it's a...
Where did you get the last name?
Laconius, yeah, Laconius. I don't know.
What about the idea? I think I first heard it or got started on it here a few years ago. But the Joseph Smith's life, can we see it seen as resolving a conflict between his mother and his father? His mother being a religious fanatic who was always looking, you know, for the a right church, and the father who thought they were all bullshit or something. And so Joseph says, "You're both right."
Yeah, there's. I think that's an important aspect. His mother was more looking for the correct apostolic church and states this. She passively goes along with the belief in magic and states this, that the family was participating in the world of abrek and magic. The father was much more heavily involved in magic and the belief in dead spirits protecting treasures. And this was seen by Protestant, mainline Protestant at the time, as dabbling with evil spirits. So these are two opposite kind of philosophies in the home, and Joseph does unite them into Mormonism. And then since the beginning of Mormonism, the magic has been steadily pushed down, but never eliminated. There's nearly 4,000 changes in the Book of Mormon since its first edition. First edition's available, and that's a photocopy I use, but there's bad grammar throughout. I mean,
oh,
really.
It's very crude. Very
yeah.
crude.
Yeah.
Can you explain away with the
I don't know enough about that to comment. I just don't know enough about that to comment. Whether there's something in a more broad, widespread form of supernatural phenomena or people who are sensitive and somehow attuned to things, such as messages from the outer universe or something important. I have not delved into that. With Joseph Smith, at least, I think there's a sufficient explanation.
You know, they always had the vision, the diorama in the Pfister Center. They don't have anything.
Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram have been moved from center of the Temple Square off to a corner, and the emphasis is shifting toward mainline Christianity.
The mother is so important in a young child's life. Why is there not more femininity in the Book of Mormon? If this is all... Well, I mean, she was there about the...
There's only three women named in the Book of Mormon. Three women named in the Book of Mormon. There's about 200 men. Three women named in the Book of Mormon. One of them is his mother, renamed Sariah, in the very first story. The second is his wife, renamed Abish, in one of the stories. And the third one is Eliza Winter, renamed the harlot Isabel.
Well, does that mean that he did not deal with femininity? He tuned it out, or she was so weak that there was not compassion in it? It's all war and blood.
And there are other episodes where he changes people from women into men in the Book of Mormon. So basically it one begins to wonder if women had any importance to him at all.
Yeah, I was thinking polygamy later on. Where was his idea of masculinity?
Yeah.
Somewhere I read that I don't want to cover this.
You missed all the best part.
Where
Yeah, Solomon Spaulding.
Manuscript.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This was the first explanation, naturalistic explanation for the Book of Mormon. And it lasted from the publication in 1834 of Mormonism Unveiled, in which it was the primary thesis. And it gathered tidbits as it rolled along for the next number of years until 1884, claiming pretty much that an old Presbyterian minister in poor health had written this fantasy as an attempt to try and write something to get him out of debt. And that ended up in the printers, and then was lost. Everybody believed, and it remained lost until 1884, when it was found among the papers of the previous owner of the printing plant in Honolulu, and then brought back to the United States. And it now resides in Oberlin College in Ohio. It's been published by our church many times, and it is a fantasy story occurring about, I think it's about 300 A.D. of a Roman group of people coming to the United States. And there are some similarities with the Book of Mormon, but not very many, and certainly not convincing. And it's been pretty much laid to rest and buried in a coffin by anyone who's investigated it fairly heavy, both Mormon and non-Mormon. Both devout Mormons and devout anti-Mormons have pretty much laid the story to rest. No. And by known history, Sidney Rigdon didn't meet Joseph Smith until 6 months after the Book of Mormon was published. And before that time, during the time the Book of Mormon was published, he was fairly prominent in the Campbellites, and his whereabouts can be quite closely traced. In fact, Fawn Brody has done that. And he was 250 miles away in Kirkland. And in Ohio, you know, baptizing and marrying and doing things and making it almost impossible for him to have any connection before what he said and everybody else said. He met Joseph Smith 6 months after the book was published.
Theoretical question, I'm trying to get to know how you might use this method. But theoretically, what I've heard, the method you've used in doing your analysis this morning could be used on Isaiah, too, if you had Isaiah's family history, right?
Maybe.
Any prophetic joke. Like, is your assumption that you know nothing about ultimate sources in terms of a supernatural explanation, and therefore the explanation that you feel most satisfied with, be it Isaiah or Joseph Smith or anybody, is one that's natural and psychological?
That's the first place we should look. Supernatural implies the exception. If supernatural exists, it's the second place, not before the second, but not the first. We have an obligation, I think, to look for things the naturalistic form. I think that should be our first source if anybody makes a supernatural claim.
So how do you see Jesus?
That's beyond this topic today.
Not as much as Isaiah.
Right.
Just personally, I think I've noticed in reading the Book of Mormon the last time through that once in a while the voice changes and it's clearly not Nephi speaking, and not somebody else speaking, it's Joseph Smith speaking. It sounds to me like the voice, all of a sudden he's talking like he would talk as an exhort on the street.
Yeah. I think a lot of different people in Joseph Smith's day, and these include the Reverend Benjamin Stockton, the Reverend George Lane, Isaac Hale, the members of the Methodist Episcopalian Church in Harmony, Pennsylvania, that hated him. This is Hale and Joseph Lewis. All of these people speak through Joseph Smith into the Book of Mormon. And I think by finding the chronological history, what he's doing, finding single things that pointed out, you can put the stories together and find out who's saying what.
Okay. Has anyone else done this, the psychological technique, the analysis that you're doing?
With regard to the Book of Mormon?
Yes.
No, not that I don't know of anybody.
Logical. Otherwise, I think a lot of people have seen the similarity with the family and the brothers in Nephi. I mean, I think a lot of us, that's kind of obvious if you want to think of that, but never taken it any further.
Well, we just had a psychiatrist walk in the room who's doing something with Joseph Smith. I'm not quite sure what. Anyway, he may be doing something. I don't know if Jess is. Jess Grosbeck, yeah.
What was your first clue? What really got you rolling?
Wine. In the Book of Mormon. In the Book of Mormon. In the Book of Mormon.
Really? Because he turned down the wine as an anesthetic.
If you play the tape from last year, and I kept saying, I decided I was going to really be a scientist. And I was going to exclude everything else. And I said, I've got to start with the Book of Mormon from scratch. And I've just got to look at it as if it's on the couch. And then the question is, who are these people? What are they doing? Who are these people? And starting with the Book of Mormon, it was Laban. Who is Laban? 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 For a while, I can remember the thought of Caleb Howard and things like that. And then just, it was like a first vision. Suddenly, it was wine. And suddenly, everything began then to fall into place. Everything. And after that, once I began to understand what he was doing, and I found out the mental, how he twisted the stories into exaggerated compensation, always compensating. His disaster, personal disaster, he compensates for him. If you use that as the formula for understanding the Book of Mormon, you can take the Book of Mormon and divide it by exaggerated compensation, and you'll get the story of Joseph Smith. If you take the Joseph Smith story and multiply by the factor of exaggerated compensation, you get the Book of Mormon story. And then everything, all the stories, one by one, began to fall into place.
What's your book out?
God knows. I'm hopefully on my last